So there you are, minding your own business, working a shift, when a patient comes in complaining of weakness. Only they don't still have any weakness. They had weakness. Right now they're fine. How should we be managing that patient? For the answer to that question,
Camberg is back with a rational approach to something we see so commonly, but it gives us no end of grief because the workup and disposition, well, not always obvious, and that is TIA, the transient ischemic attack. Let's start off with that, Cam. Actually, the definition. What is a TIA? Seems like a simple question, but it's hard to get a straight answer these days.
It is kind of hard to get a straight answer. So when you first said that we should talk about TIA, I was not overly excited. And then as we spent the last couple kind of weeks and months hashing this out, it's been more and more interesting to me. And I think starting with the definition is a great place to begin. First of all, I remember learning in medical school one definition of TIA, in residency another one. And now when I've read more about it in recent months, I've kind of developed a third interpretation of it. So for the purposes of this conversation, I think what we should agree on is a consensus definition of the TIA, and that is a transient neurological deficit, a brief stroke syndrome, if you will, that results in spontaneous resolution. So I think most germane to the rest of the conversation that we have, a TIA does not obligatorily require an entirely negative workup. And specifically, the TIA diagnosis doesn't depend on entirely negative neuroimaging. So it's really a clinical definition. It's a patient who comes in and they either report what sounds like a vascular territory stroke that got better, or you see them with that stroke syndrome and it resolves during the time you're treating them. We're not going to otherwise kind of talk about how long it takes. It's all based on the clinical appearance and the clinical resolution.
It's confusing because many patients with TIA will get thrombolytics, and we only figured out after the fact that it was something that was self-limited to begin with, such as you're pushing the lytics and seconds later they're getting better. Okay, that wasn't the lytics. That was just they were going to get better on their own.
That's true. And that's a really difficult thing to kind of figure out, the proportion of patients who have this phenomena in the literature. I don't think it's a lot of patients, but it certainly happens. You know, most of the thrombolytic registry level data suggests that it's a small proportion of patients who kind of inappropriately really receive lytics for what are called stroke mimics. And one of those is, of course, a TIA. And when we talk about, you know, push the lytics and then the patient gets better, I think it's always important to remember that the randomized stroke trials, I mean, NINS type data, really only showed clinical divergence or clinical improvement at 30 days. So we always like to think that we're going to push the lytics, we're going to reassess the NIH stroke score, we're hoping it's going to get better. But the data suggests otherwise. It really suggests that the clinical improvement is a lagging indicator for lytics and their effect, you know, if they have an effect at all, frankly. So for the rest of the conversation, let's focus on the patient who doesn't qualify for, does not receive lytics. And generally speaking, these are the kind of patients who have normalized by the time we initially see them.
Fair enough. I accept those ground rules and I feel comfortable with proceeding.
So, all right, we're on the same page.
Why do we even care about TIA? Is it because it's the canary in the coal mine, the sentinel event for stroke, and you have one of these, little facial droop for an hour? A full-fledged debilitating stroke is coming soon, coming fast. What's the deal? So I ask you, can we reliably predict stroke in these patients? Is the something like the ABCD2 score useful for us?
So I'll answer each of those questions in order. Can we reliably predict stroke after TIA? No. Is the ABCD2 useful for us? No.
Gotta say, I was expecting a much longer segment from Cam and Rob, but I guess we're done.
That's right. That's it, folks. That's the show. Tune in next time for another edition of Cam Berg's Binary Answers to Complicated Medical Questions. We'll see you next time.
Unless, of course, you actually want a bit of explanation about Cam's answers.
ABCD squared.
For a time, and that time was not that long ago, there was a lot of excitement about the idea of clinical risk stratification scores in TIA. So we in emergency medicine like scores. We use scores for almost any condition, and a lot of different scores were proposed or derived or even validated when it comes to TIA. And I think these have been discussed on EM Wrap, and most of us are familiar with a handful of them. And ABCD2 is by far the big one, you know, age, blood pressure, clinical features, and diabetes. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time digging into the elements of it and the cut points because I'm really not bullish about the utility of the ABCD2 score. When different sites sought to externally validate the performance of ABCD2, they showed that different populations, you know, kind of the case mix seen by different centers is highly variable. So it probably helps to start off and say, what is the risk of stroke after a TIA? And the ballpark figure for you to keep in mind is an annual risk of something like 2%, 3%, or 4%, depending on your specific patient case mix. So it's not really high, but it's not zero. So what ABCD2 allows you to do is be a bit more specific when considering the patient-specific features in front of you. And you can get a little bit better with your estimate of stroke risk. And it might range from as low as less than 1% to as high as maybe 20% over the next year in some studies.
Here's the crux of the situation with TIA. Some of the patients are going to go on to develop a full-blown CVA, probably around 2 to 3% over the year. But some of these patients are going to develop that CVA in the next 7 days. Overall, about 50% of the strokes that do develop happen in 7 days or so. ABCD squared was designed to help us figure out the risk of stroke at 90 days, as well as the risk of stroke in the next 7 days. But it falls short in one important place, and that's inter-rater reliability. Basically, take a single patient and take two docs. There's a good chance they'll disagree on the ABCD squared score on that patient. If you do like the ABCD squared tool, you can use MD Calc to plug in the patient's info, and it's going to spit out a 90-day, 7-day, and a 2-day CVA risk based on their features. The question we really need to ask is, what's the benefit of bringing the TIA patient into the hospital for a workup?
What's often said is that we admit, and we've been talking about the risk of stroke, say the patient has a stroke in the next however many hours. They're usually in the hospital for a day or two. And if they're in the hospital during that time, they can get thrombolytics.
Ignoring the theoretic ability to expedite lytic therapy in the event of a short-term acute stroke occurring during observation, there's really not much that a hospital can fundamentally do that a clinic cannot. So we need to think about reversible conditions, about treatable pathology, and we need to address each of those variables as they pertain to a particular patient.
Did you hear that sound? That was my mind blowing right there. That's what that sounds like. All right, so a patient has a TIA. They are now fine. What can we do to help them?
Yeah, it's arguably even lower yield than the palpitations on telemetry or than the hospital observation for syncope. I mean, it's really the vast minority of patients that are even theoretically benefited from hospitalization. We need to pretend like we're neurologists for a minute.
And what a neurologist would do is look at the TIA symptoms, the pattern, the vascular distribution, and use all those factors to determine if the patient has modifiable risk factors that can lead to benefit.
So first, and by far the most important predisposing condition, is a new and previously undiagnosed cardiac arrhythmia. Almost always in the case of TIA, this is AFib. We, as emergency medicine physicians, are experts at diagnosing, risk stratifying, and treating AFib. I mean, I think we all know how to do that. It's an evolving field, and we're on top of it. But you have to look for it. And so oftentimes, you know, we think of TIA, we think of stroke, and we forget that probably the highest yield test is to get an electrocardiogram. And it probably makes sense that while they're in the apartment, we keep them on telemetry. But you're absolutely right, Rob. Seldom do we find things on telemetry that were not present on that initial screening ECG. Next off, we need to think about anatomy. And it sounds silly, but TIAs occur due to transient cerebral ischemia. And so this can occur because of a thrombotic event, you know, very similar to a heart attack, but a heart attack in the brain, or it can occur because of a critical vascular stenosis that just kind of progresses to the point that it's leading to territorial ischemia. So classically, I think all of us think of carotid stenosis as a risk factor. I mean, we're always kind of checking the carotids, but patients can, of course, have stenosis or even occlusion of other cervical vessels. I mean, even intracranial vessels. We in medicine have studied the impact of different interventions on stenoses or thromboses or occlusions in these different anatomic locations. And the good news is you don't have to remember much, because we've learned that intervention is only beneficial when it's used in the extracranial anterior circulation. I mean, that is the common carotid. That is the only lesion that is amenable to a surgical intervention in TIA that benefits patients. So things like the posterior circulation, you know, when we're talking about vertebrals or the intracranial segments of the internal carotid, these are things we see on imaging, but we have learned that interventions don't help the patients. They actually paradoxically increase the risk of harm. So what I recommend is you actually think about your patient. Does the deficit that's reported by the patient in front of you map to the anterior circulation or the posterior circulation? And if it's anterior, you should think about obtaining imaging of the carotid vessels. You know, you can do that in the ED, or you can arrange for that to happen as an outpatient. And then finally, we have to think about predisposing medical conditions. So I'm going to mention a few of them, but there's really only one that has short-term benefit. There's really only one that we need to be treating from the ED, and that is this idea of kind of a hyperthrombotic state, or the fact that TIA can happen due to thrombosis, so we should probably treat patients with antiplatelet agents. That does have a short-term benefit. The other things are really primary and secondary prevention style medicine. I mean, this is hyperlipidemia, hypertension, hyperglycemia, and even lifestyle stuff like smoking cessation, alcohol use, physical activity, and weight loss. These are all factors that have proven benefit, but it's not benefit on the order of an ED timeframe. These are things for primary care docs and neurologists to know about. So there's things for us to think about. There's things for us to address, maybe in a pre-contemplation sort of way with patients. I mean, you usually stop smoking, you should have your cholesterol checked. But I don't think from the ED we need to be escalating blood pressure management, checking A1Cs, prescribing statins. These are all things that can happen from home.
Get an EKG looking for atrial fibrillation. If the patient has it, that's a big risk factor for developing a CVA, so you're going to initiate management. Think about the distribution of the TIA. If it's anterior, consider getting carotid imaging, as significant stenosis may result in an endarterectomy for the patient, and consider starting the patient on an antiplatelet agent in the emergency department. Typically, aspirin is going to be our first line here.
We're going to get back to the antiplatelet agents in a few, but in your opinion, what is the ideal workup of a patient who's had a TIA? Let's just say you've got carte blanche. You have every study possible. And if you don't, say you don't have every study possible, what is the necessary workup? So you've got ideal and necessary.
I think over the last few years, you've learned that I'm generally a fan of fairly judicious testing, not just kind of doing everything because we have it. And this is true in TIA, but based on my recent reading, I've become much more excited about the diagnostic benefit of MRI. I mean, it's the really expensive test and it's really fancy, but I think it helps. So a lot of recent data suggests that an urgent or an ED MRI is tremendously helpful in terms of risk stratifying patients. And to get this, all you need is the basic non-contrast diffusion-weighted brain series. I mean, this is something you can actually do in about 10 minutes if you get the patient in the MRI scanner, so it doesn't take hours. If this MRI shows ischemia, shows a diffusion-weighted imaging abnormality, then the patient is at a very high risk for short-term stroke. And most of the good series suggest about a 10% risk of stroke in the next 72 hours. So that's a real deal kind of risk. I think that this is better than the more complicated ABCD2 score. And it also allows you to do the other things you want to do with neuroimaging. You can rule out other causes of deficits like hemorrhage, trauma, mass lesion, etc. Generally speaking, and classically, TIAs should have a normal MRI. But about 10% of the cases where the patient has had complete clinical resolution will actually have a diffusion-weighted imaging abnormality. So on the MRI, it actually looks like a stroke, but the patient in front of you doesn't look like a stroke. And we call that a TIA with diffusion-weighted imaging abnormality. And these are the patients that I think should be admitted to the hospital. Lastly, like, what else is good about MRI? Well, you can obviously image the carotids with the MRI, and it's a better test than an ultrasound. So if you have the ability to get an MRI and you're already going to get it, and the patient in front of you appears to have a syndrome that maps to the anterior circulation, I think it's reasonable to just go ahead and get an MR angiogram of the cervical vessels.
But a lot of us don't have MRI readily available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for this level of neuroimaging. I think routine MRI is still a bit controversial, and I'm sure we'll get some thoughts on this from others. Non-con head CT is great for finding acute hemorrhage, and you really need contrast if you're worried about an aneurysm anyway. These unusual patients who have resolved TIA symptoms but perfusion deficits on MRI are interesting, but I think the jury remains out on how best to manage these patients. What if MRI isn't on the table?
MRI is not going to fundamentally change your management, though it may guide your disposition. So I still think if you don't have an MRI, you need to get some kind of brain imaging, and that should probably be a non-contrast head CT. Just about all of us can do that. You should still do your electrocardiogram. You should still think about the other predisposing conditions, and you can try to use something like an ABCD2 score if you want, if you like that kind of thing, to help further guide your conversation with the patient. You know, regarding the timing of all these tests, on a guideline level, we have a lot of leeway. So the American Heart Association, American Stroke Association say that it's reasonable to perform this entire workup in short term as an outpatient, and they define short term as within the next week.
Patient comes in with a TIA that is completely resolved. You've got a normal EKG, finger stick, vitals, and a non-con head CT, and now you've got the choice to admit for further evaluation or discharge the patient home with close follow-up with a neurologist. That follow-up should probably be done in about a week, so if you can get it done in a week, great, you have this option on the table. If you can't, you're probably going to need to keep the patient in-house. Now, I use the ABCD squared score to help guide my decision-making here. If the patient has a high score, I'll probably put the patient in observation to get the further evaluation in-house. But if they're low risk, I'm probably going to recommend sending them out with close follow-up. All right, that's part one of the Cam Berg Reasonable Approach to TIA Management. We'll be back with part two later in the program.
Paper chase paper number
two.
Next paper, effect of volume of fluid resuscitation on metabolic normalization in children presenting in DKA. A randomized controlled trial. It's another RCT.
The bottom line.
Two different initial fluid volumes, 10. 10-